Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, who's setting the agenda in City Hall, the mayor or the city council? We talk to a local government expert about how those power dynamics will shape the road ahead. Later in the program, a watershed plan to clean up the St. John's and a photographer's wild journey into the ecology of the Sunshine State. But first, we welcome attorney Chris Hand, who, in addition to being a former Senate press secretary, speechwriter, and mayoral chief of staff, actually wrote operating instructions for the country. Literally, the book is called America, the Owner's Manual. Chris Hand, thank you so much for being here this morning.
And thank you for having me.
And if you have questions about what's happening inside City Hall and why, Chris is here for it. Give us a call at 904-549-2937 or email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also reach out via social media, be it X or Facebook or Instagram. Chris, let's start off with some good news for Jacksonville. It was an announcement Monday that Jacksonville's signature downtown revitalization project, the Emerald Trail, is about to get a big chunk of change, $147 million from the federal government. Tell us where this money is coming from and why we're getting it.
Well, Ann, first of all, as you say, it was announced on Monday. Two members of Congress representing the Jacksonville area, Aaron Bean and John Rutherford, sent out a press release indicating that they'd gotten notice that the Jacksonville Transportation Authority and the city of Jacksonville are going to receive what's called the Neighborhood Equity and Accessibility Grant. That is something that was passed during the Inflation Reduction Act in 2022 to help connect particularly underserved communities. JTA has been working on this for quite some time, trying to help bring this money in to support the Emerald Trail project as part of an overall JTA effort to increase grant funding for a variety of transportation priorities. So this is the second big financial tranche for the Emerald Trail. It received an initial one a couple of years ago when the city council passed an enhanced gas tax here in town. That directed about $135 million to the Emerald Trail. This grant now provides for $147 million for design, planning, and ultimately construction of what will be a 30-mile network of trails, greenways, and parks connecting about 14 different historic neighborhoods here in Jacksonville. So this is very significant news for the Emerald Trail initiative that we've got. Now, we have not yet heard from the city or from JTA, but we have heard from these two members of Congress who received the notification of grant award about this nearly $150 million.
So this initial money that was received, you mentioned, was when the city council doubled the gas tax. So it appears, you know, we can have nice things sometimes, but it does cost money. I'm curious about the politics of that. Why is it that we're hearing from two Republican lawmakers in Washington, D.C. about this allocation and not hearing from the city? This money was pursued after an agreement between the city and Groundworks Jacksonville and the JTA last year that basically made JTA the lead on pursuing some of these federal dollars from the Biden administration infrastructure, you know, fund. Why isn't the mayor taking ownership or benefiting, I guess, in some way from this announcement?
I don't think we know that yet, Anne. We'll have to see. It is somewhat curious that the city hasn't made a statement about this yet and that we've heard from the, you know, from the two members of Congress. I don't know if it's because the city's waiting for, you know, an official announcement from USDOT or, you know, something else like that. The notice of grant award has gone out, and they regularly send these to members of Congress who then immediately turn around and announce them. That's been going on for decades in Congress. So a little bit curious that the city has not yet said anything about that. This was one of Mayor Deegan's, she had seven priorities in her inaugural address, her July 1st, 2023 inaugural address, and funding riverfront parks and completing the Emerald Trail was one of those seven priorities. So perhaps we'll hear something in the days to come from the city, but regardless, this is a very significant grant award that's going to go to the city of Jacksonville, and probably between this and the funding that was provided with that enhanced gas tax, probably provides most of the funds at this point to complete the Emerald Trail. And by the way, that investment that the city council made through that enhanced gas tax in the Emerald Trail, if I had to guess, was very significant in these federal dollars being awarded. Obviously, the federal government, when it's looking at these types of grant applications, wants to see, do cities have skin in the game? Have they actually invested in themselves? Those that do often have an advantage in these competitive grant processes, and I suspect that was the case with this one as well.
This project has also had really significant buy-in from the nonprofit and philanthropic community. We've had big donations from ViStar, the Paget family, Dolores Barr Weaver, David Miller. Even Swisher gave, I think, $500,000 to completing part of the S Trail. That's, you know, a big part of this. It's expected to be built by 2029, and it may actually be on track. I want to ask you how that dovetails with some downtown development questions that have arisen. You know, there have been some setbacks. We've discussed on this program a little bit in the past, but just, you know, recently, obviously the fire at the Doro Rise building was a loss of, you know, a step forward and then kind of two steps back. But the old Roosevelt Hotel and the original Independent Life building right there by the federal courthouse, those have kind of been abandoned. It looks like those projects, they've defaulted, I guess, the investors or the property owners. The plan that was going to build a tower at the Jacksonville Landing appears to be on ice. And then the Hardwick at the old Duval County Courthouse site. So there've been a lot of, you know, visible setbacks. And then, you know, something like the Emerald Trail seems like moving forward with really, you know, a cool network to connect the ecology, the riverfront, and some struggling neighborhoods.
Well, on the downtown development projects, I think we really are sort of at an important pivot point of this. This is not to suggest, and maybe as some have, that downtown revitalization is dead or is not happening. I think the jury is out on that. But as you say, there have been some very notable downtown development projects that have gone off the board. You talked about the American Lions Tower that was going to be on the former Jacksonville Landing site. That has now been canceled. The Hardwick property that was going to be on the former Duval County Courthouse site, that has been canceled. You talked about in the western part of downtown, these historic preservation projects like the Ambassador Hotel and the old Independent Life building.
And the Laura Street Trio.
Well, and that, I was just going to say, in addition to those that have gone off the board, there are a couple that are sort of in limbo right now, that are a little bit in development purgatory. Those include the Laura Street Trio, which of the, you know, the collection of three buildings right in the core of downtown that the city of Jacksonville has been attempting to develop now for the better part of the last quarter century. A lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money has gone into this. In a recent column that I wrote on this subject, I suggested that it's really sort of now time to either put up or shut up on the Laura Street Trio. There's a current developer. The city is now, after a very contentious process through the Jacksonville City Council and the DIA, have gone back to have talks with that developer, given all this time that's passed. And look, there's some risk here. These are old buildings that the longer time goes on without having them redeveloped, the more likely you're going to pass a point of no return where they can't be redeveloped anymore because of the degradation of these historic buildings. So this is one that I think, particularly because it's right in the core, ought to be a priority for the city of Jacksonville. And if they can't reach an agreement with the current developer, really by the end of this month, it might be time to offer him a fair price at that point and see if you can do this development some other way. Another critical project is the one, the property right now that's owned by the related group on the site of the former River City Brewing Company, right next to Friendship Fountain, which we know was recently reactivated there. This is a crucial site on the South Bank. This project could be hugely impactful for downtown. And again, right now the city appears to be sort of stuck in some negotiations with the related group. So these are two projects in particular that, if they moved forward, could have an outsized impact on the future of downtown revitalization. But right now, they're not moving forward. They seem to be stuck in neutral. So we'll have to pay very close attention to that.
And of course, one other project on the South Bank is the future of the Duval County School Board building. I want to get to that in just a minute, but we've got to call Jim from Orange Park. Good morning, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Hey, so just to be clear, the grant was under the Jobs and Infrastructure bill that was passed?
It was actually under the Inflation Reduction Act. This particular program, as you're pointing out, Jim, there were two very large bills that had infrastructure impacts. One was the Infrastructure and Jobs Act that passed in 2021. The Inflation Reduction Act passed in 2022. This particular grant stems from the latter of those two legislative initiatives.
Okay, that's great. Okay, my point on this is I'm pretty sure that both of those individuals, Rutherford and the other, voted against both of those. But yet once again, they're taking credit probably for the fact that, hey, you know, we're getting this money. And so I agree that, you know, Donna Deegan needs to step up and say, hey, you know what, even though they voted against it, we're still getting this money. And so many times I see, you know, Republican congressmen and senators coming back to their states after something they voted against, taking credit for it. So that's just my point. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, just to be clear, Jim, I mean, for example, Congressman Aaron Bean just took office in January of 2023. So he was actually not a member of Congress when both the infrastructure bill and the Inflation Reduction Act. I believe you're correct about Congressman Rutherford, but we've seen this kind of happen in a number of parts of the country after the passage of the infrastructure bill and the Inflation Reduction Act, including right here in Florida. After that passed, the original infrastructure bill directed a very large sum of money to the restoration of the Florida Everglades. And, you know, fairly quickly after that happened, a variety of members of Congress, including some who had not been supportive of the bill, were, you know, kind of lauding and trumpeting and having press conferences related to this. So, I mean, it's really an old phenomenon in politics. And I'll borrow a line from Ricky Bobby in Talladega Nights. When it comes to these grants, if you're not first, you're last. And so it is, I think, really important for those who have, obviously, you want to work closely with the agencies that are awarding them, and I completely understand that you want to maintain protocol. But I also think very important when news like this comes out as quickly as possible to make sure, really for the benefit of citizens who are going to benefit from these projects, make sure they understand you know, what has occurred here, what the impact's going to be, and how that might impact their daily lives. And if the person or the entity that has applied for and is seeking the grant doesn't tell that story, someone else is going to.
So to the question of the future of the Duval County School Board headquarters, there was discussion this week as to whether that building might be sold off and the district move to somewhere in Riverside or perhaps a new building by the JTA, you know, superplex transportation hub. Why is that debate? Well, tell us what happened, first of all.
Well, I think the best way to sum it up would be that meet the new Duval County Public Schools headquarters. It's the same as the old Duval County Public School headquarters. And as you know, there's been talk for decades in this community about the fact that the Duval County Public Schools have their headquarters on the St. Johns River in really sort of prime riverfront property on the South Bank. And a lot of discussion about, you know, should they move off the river? Where could they go instead? Well, 4 years ago in 2020, the Duval County School Board commissioned a process to determine if they could find a new home off the river. And this took the better part of 3.5 years. A lot of different sort of firms and companies bid for the opportunity to move them kind of off the headquarters, and very sort of long and winding road to get to this point. But ultimately, the school board winnowed down the candidates to two. One was the Florida Blue Tower on Riverside Avenue, which, by the way, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office is also looking at as a new administrative headquarters. That would have cost the school district about $68 million in lease payments over 20 years. And then also JTA offered to build and lease to the school board a new building on their La Villa, right next to their La Villa campus in downtown Jacksonville. That would have ultimately cost about $128 million over 20 years. School board ran the numbers, found out that they would actually be less costly, better for taxpayers, if they simply stayed in their current building. So after 4 years and a lot of time and a lot of inputs, the school board's made the decision for now to stay right where they are on the South Bank here in Jacksonville.
I mean, we've heard for years a lot of talk about trying to get government off of the river. And yet, even as it's moved, there just seems to be more and more vacant riverfront land. So is the urgency there quite in the same way it was perhaps, you know, when the Delaney administration first started advocating for clearing some of the government, you know, properties off the river?
Well, that's certainly a point that some school board members brought up during the debate yesterday, that, hey, there doesn't seem to be as much activity at some of these sites. Is it really an urgent priority for us to make this particular move? I would not be surprised, Anne, to see the school board come back to this subject once there is a new superintendent in place, which will be the case later this year, once the current school board elections are past us in August and November. As we move from 2024 to 2025, I wouldn't be surprised to see this debate come back up. Now's a little bit of a difficult time to be having this conversation, particularly if the math isn't working out. And we know a variety of issues like inflation have infected, have affected costs in this situation. So I would say this is probably more of a postponement than it is an outright cancellation of this discussion.
I was surprised to learn, though, that the money that they would make from that sale, whatever it would be, millions of dollars, that they couldn't use that to pay for their new digs wherever they end up.
There's some limitations on the use of these kinds of dollars under the law. You can use them for building maintenance and those types of things, but can't use them to pay for the cost of a new building. I think that was really a game changer in this discussion. The school board and the Duval County Schools were really counting on the proceeds from selling this building to help mitigate the costs of a new building. And when they found out that they couldn't transfer that over, at that point, the costs of a new building were competing with instructional costs, paying teachers, providing for students, and the school board ultimately decided that those were their priorities, not investing taxpayer dollars in a new headquarters.
We've got a call, John, on the South Side. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Well, good morning, Ann and Chris, and thank you for taking my call. I just want to start off with a little jingle. Follow the Emerald Trail, follow the Emerald Trail, follow the Emerald Trail. We're paying the tax, the wonderful, wonderful tax. So we doubled our gas tax, and now we're getting a federal, grant. But when it comes to the Emerald Trail, and just connecting all these various neighborhoods, I just get back even to the waterways component. And you were just talking about the school board property. In 2016-18 was the legislation that was a fine grant that got moved to a CIP that created that kayak launch. That's right in the back. On the water. But what I want to share with you tonight or today is that there's going to be a meeting at the Ed Ball Building, concerning the old armory. And, it's going to be at 3:00, and then there's another meeting tomorrow. And so, Chris and Ann, with all these different projects, the real key component is the public having access to these various projects, especially if they're tied into the waterways. Now, I go back to 2013, 384. That was the initial dollar that was going to be given to the armory, back then in 2013. And then that meeting, I asked the developers, would you allow public access to Hogan's Creek? The answer was yes. And ultimately, the legislation got withdrawn. But going forward, Chris, Ann, can you just talk about, and you're going to have the Riverkeeper on later. They're at JU. Can you or I just access waterways at JU?
John, I appreciate your feedback. John Nooney, of course, a huge advocate for river access for many, many years. And that is one thing that this trail would do. It kind of connect some disadvantaged neighborhoods to the water, which is important for people to appreciate the resource and kind of understand its significance in the environment and the economy of Florida.
Well, that's right. And first of all, John makes a very important case about the importance of effective citizenship and involving citizens in the process. I know from my time at City Hall that John is a very active participant in the city process himself, particularly on these waterways issues. But that's exactly right. Part of the goal of the Emerald Trail is to make sure that there is significant access to not only the St. John's River, but various tributaries that kind of go through these historic neighborhoods that are affected. So the very access that John is talking about is sort of the point of the Emerald Trail project, which, again, now looks like it has the funding to be able to, if not totally complete the project, come very close to it.
So I want to shift gears a little bit and just talk about what's happening in City Hall in terms of the power dynamics. You've written about this on your blog. The city council may be trying to set its own agenda separate and distinct from the mayor's, and those being maybe competing visions as opposed to one that is coalescing around sometimes very similar issues.
What's interesting, Anne, is when you compare the city council's priorities to the mayor's priorities, and the mayor has been very clear about her. She listed those 7 priorities in her inaugural address. Council more recently has been pretty clear about its priorities. It goes through a strategic planning exercise, and a lot of the items there are in common. The current city council president, Ron Salem, has prioritized sports tourism, which is an economic development goal, which is not incompatible with some of the economic development goals of the Deegan administration. Councils also talked about the importance of addressing affordable housing and homelessness and has set up a new committee and some new funding sources to address that. Mayor Deegan has made that a priority and actually has a staffer who's focused almost exclusively on that in her office. A variety of other goals, whether it's food security or some of the other priorities the councils are taking. So there's actually a lot in common between the two agendas. What we're just not seeing right now is sort of unity around those goals. We're seeing some back and forth between the city council and the mayor's office, but not agreement on the goals. So there's certainly potential there for the two bodies to sort of come together and reach agreement. But right now, that hasn't happened yet. They seem to be sort of at different corners of the ring.
Why is that a problem, and who do you fault for it?
Well, I think like any working relationship, it's a two-way street, and there's always steps that people on both sides of that particular relationship can take to improve it. I think one of the things that many people would like to see happen is to have this debate be over policy ideas and governing approaches as opposed to some of the issues we have seen. This is a push-pull that's existed ever since consolidation began to some extent, where we have a strong mayor system under our consolidated model. The mayor is the chief executive officer of the city. The charter could not be more clear about that. But city council at times obviously has a vital oversight role in the process. It's responsible for passing the city budget. But at times you see some conflict over the way those powers balance. And we've seen that in recent months. And the city council, you know, after the mayor's office had a single source contract to hire a federal lobbyist and grant firm, city council then passed legislation to say they can't do that. If there's a single source, it has to come through the city council. They also made some changes to the mayor, the executive branch's ability to settle lawsuits against the city. So there have been some of those sort of issues over which branch has the power, when in fact, I think the conversation that a lot of people would like to see is the competition of ideas over how to move the city of Jacksonville forward. Our colleague A.G. Gankarski has written about this quite eloquently, talking about the need for, you know, both sides of the fourth floor of City Hall to come together and find some shared sustainable solutions and sort of not waste this moment. So I think there's a lot of interest in, hey, it's okay, there's going to be a natural competition at times between these two co-equal branches of government, but maybe let's have the competition be over what are the ideas to help move Jacksonville forward.
You mentioned A.G. Gankarski. We had him on yesterday. I was fascinated to learn you guys were classmates. I didn't know that.
Well, we weren't classmates, but we were in high school at the same time. He went to Bishop Kenny. I went to Fletcher. But we've known each other since 1990. So I have now known A.G. for almost 35 years at this point and count myself as very lucky. He does a lot of great reporting and did a great job on the show yesterday summarizing the legislative session.
Well, we're so lucky to have you as well. Chris Hand, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom about what's happening in local government. And we really like these monthly visits.
Look forward to seeing you next month, Ann.
All right. Up next, a spring cleaning for the state's longest and laziest river. We'll tell you how you can get involved.
Why not always be the ocean where I unravel? Be my only, be the water where I'm waiting. You're my river running high, run deep, run.
Welcome back. Have you ever wondered who's responsible for cleaning garbage out of local waterways? Well, it turns out nobody is. There are no agencies at the state, local, or federal level charged with pulling out trash and tires. That job actually falls entirely to volunteers, and more are needed. I'm joined now by Jimmy Orth. He's the executive director of conservation and advocacy with the St. John's Riverkeeper. And Jimmy, welcome. I just want to note that last month you celebrated 20 years with the Riverkeeper organization. Congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. It's been 20 years of a lot of fun, but also a lot of challenges, I can say.
Well, your commitment is admirable and some difficult work that you've done. So the St. John's River Cleanup, the Great St. John's River Cleanup, is about to get underway this Saturday, and it runs with a number of events around the watershed. Tell us a little bit about that event and how it all ties together.
Yeah, well, a lot of folks may be aware that Duval County's been hosting a St. John's River cleanup for now, this year, 29 years. And what we wanted to do, though, is we wanted to actually expand this effort to include other counties throughout the watershed. A lot of people don't realize, but the watershed of the St. John's River is about 9,000 square miles. There's 13 counties that touch the river. It's the longest river in Florida as well, at 310 miles long. So what we wanted to do is involve the other people throughout the watershed. So we started 2 years ago the Great St. John's River Cleanup, which is a collaboration of cleanups throughout the watershed. So we're working with 7, hopefully 8 counties this year with cleanups that people can get involved throughout the watershed. And it's really a way to galvanize people, bring people together so that we can work collectively to protect and restore the St. John's River.
And so this was something that years ago was kind of manned by the St. John's River Water Management District, which is a government body, and there's 5 of them in the state, but the St. John's one did organize cleanups that I had done before too, and they don't do it anymore. What happened?
Well, it became too much of an effort for them to manage, because there was literally a cleanup on the same day every year that involved just about all the counties in the watershed. And what happened is they just decided they didn't have the resources to do it anymore. And so, unfortunately, a lot of the counties decided to quit hosting cleanups after that. Duval has continued, thankfully. But what we wanted to do is kind of recreate that effort where we're trying to get all the counties pitching in, working together to collaborate throughout. This is not one day anymore. It actually extends until April 25th.
And so there are cleanups in a variety of counties, you said. How do people connect with those cleanups if they want to? How do they, is there like information on your website, or do they have to find their own local place?
You can go to our website. We have a page set up with all links to all the different county websites for the cleanups. We actually have a URL, stjohnsrivercleanup.com. So if you just go to stjohnsrivercleanup.com, we have all the information there. You can also, for the one that kicks off this Saturday in Duval, which there's over 40 cleanup sites in Duval County alone this Saturday, you can also just go to the jacksonville.gov website, the city of Jacksonville's website, search in the search engine for St. John's River Cleanup, and you'll find information about all those sites as well.
You and I were talking a little bit about how this could be an opportunity, not just for people who care about the river, but actually for students who are trying to get together their Bright Future Scholarship. I mean, this is a volunteer opportunity. And, you know, it's even possible that somebody could volunteer over many days, given, you know, the length of this cleanup across all of the counties in the watershed.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a great opportunity for students. Now, I know Duval's cleanup, they do require the ones here in Jacksonville that you be 18 years or older or accompanied by an adult. So they would have to be accompanied by an adult. But, yes, students can come out, bring your parents, and get out there and clean up the river this weekend. And then also look on our website, and you can find other cleanups. There's going to be cleanups coming up in Clay County, Putnam County, Volusia County, Seminole, Orange, and St. John's.
So the issue of trash in the river, it's not just unsightly. It has some, you know, actual harmful impacts for wildlife and the waterways and the creatures that live there. Talk a little bit about what we're seeing, particularly when it comes to, like, plastic pollution.
Well, I think that's something that's really concerning, is because a lot of the cleanups that you, if you go to attend, you'll see a lot of it is packaging. It's single-use plastic packaging for different products that are, and those things don't break down. Plastics can take decades before it breaks down. And then part of the problem is, too, is as it breaks down, those particles get smaller and smaller, and people may have heard the term microplastics. There's actually microplastics probably in our bodies right now. We're finding that this is so pervasive on our planet. But it also causes all kinds. It can cause health risk for wildlife, for humans as well. We've probably all seen the horrific images of animals, their necks caught in, you know, a six-pack, a plastic ring. It can cause strangulation. It can cause them to they ingest it and can kill wildlife. And then a lot of this is actually, as it breaks down, like plastic bags. There was a study a couple of years ago that as plastic bags break down, there's about 13,000 chemical compounds in those bags that then can be released. And not all are harmful, but a lot of those are toxic and harmful to human and wildlife health.
So the trash component, I mean, there in some ways greater awareness that people shouldn't litter. But as you say, there's a lot of things that we didn't used to have that are now packaged and ready to go, you know, and to-go food itself, particularly since the pandemic has become a much more de rigueur kind of possession that people have.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's more pervasive. We're seeing, I mean, I saw some statistic the other day that by 2050, we're going to see a doubling of the amount of plastic that's produced on this planet. So we're rapidly increasing the use of plastics, which then obviously, and so few of them get recycled. It's actually, I saw research recently that I think it's between 5 and 10% of plastic is actually recycled. So even if you throw it in the recycle bin, if it's not the right kind of plastic, or it has multiple types of plastic in it, it might not be able to be recycled.
So you've talked in theory about the idea of creating kind of a pollution limit, a threshold for garbage. And that's there are regulatory guidelines right now for the river. It's called a total maximum daily load, or TMDL. And that's basically the amount of pollution that a water body can absorb before it degrades. This is just an idea, but how could that apply to trash, and what would it trigger if it existed?
Well, I think that's one of the problems. We don't, like you mentioned earlier at the intro of this segment, is there's not really any regulatory agencies that are required to keep trash out of our waterways and then actually to remove it once it's there. A TMDL would actually require local governments to make efforts to prevent that trash from making it into the waterway in the first place. There's only like four cities and municipalities in the country that have a TMDL for trash. One's LA, San Francisco has one in New York City, and they're required in some cases to keep out at least 80% of the trash that makes it into the waterway. So they have to do things like public education campaigns, screens that go across the curb inlets that lead to the St. John's River. And those are some of the things we need to look at, is regulatory requirements to prevent this trash from making it into the waterways in the first place. And we've got to start in this country manufacturing products that are more recyclable and not allowing just single-use plastic, which is becoming so pervasive.
The task of keeping these waterways clean, it's a lot of work. And there is actually a volunteer branch of your organization that continues to clean up. I think it's McCoy's Creek. Tell us a little bit about the length of that effort and sort of the Sisyphusian nature of it.
Well, I think that's what you're referencing is we have a Rising Tides program for young professionals. They've been cleaning up McCoy's Creek, different sections of it. They go start in one end and basically finish on the other throughout the course of a year. They go every month. They've been doing it for 11 years, every single month. And still, the amount of trash that they're pulling out of McCoy's Creek is astonishing. You would think it would be getting much better over time, but it's just demonstrates how much of this trash still makes it into the waterways. People do it. In some cases, it's from illegal dumping, but in a lot of cases, it's just trash that's in the back of a pickup truck or back of a garbage truck that flies out and ends up making it into our waterways.
So last year, 1,000 volunteers collected 30,000 pounds of trash. What's the goal this year?
Well, we want to obviously do better than that. We're hoping to get 2,000 volunteers throughout the watershed. And I think this is one of those efforts. We want to increase participation, not just throughout the watershed, but definitely in Duval as well. I've been involved with the river cleanup here in Duval since its inception almost 30 years ago. And we used to get on a regular basis at least 1,000 volunteers a year. Last year, Duval had less than 400. And so we need to increase that participation, because one of the things that I think is critical is that citizens, we have to take ownership of our river. We have to pitch in and take action. And what we hope through the cleanups is that people will get involved. They'll learn more about the impacts of trash and litter, what that impact is having on the river, and they'll become advocates, because we all need to advocate for the St. John's River.
Well, Jimmy Orr, thank you so much for the work that you've done. Congratulations again on 20 years at the Riverkeeper. And you can find more information at the St. John's Riverkeeper website for the cleanup that starts this weekend.
Yes,
thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks. Please get out there and help clean up our river.
Stay tuned. I'll speak next to a Florida biologist who traded her nets and data sets for a camera and notebook.
So there's longing in the shoulders now. There was a wildness in that time. Can we now say the sweet were the hours, but hours to find. There was no way to live in simple dreams. There was no straightness to our line. Gravel in hand, the darling women.
Welcome back. From Florida's backwoods to its wetlands, Kirsten Hines explores wild Florida in a new book by the same name. I'm joined now by Florida-based biologist, conservationist, and photographer, Kirsten Hines. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Kirsten. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. So you're not just a biologist and a conservationist, but you're a very accomplished photographer and storyteller. How did the idea for this particular book, we should say you've had you have several books, but how did the idea for this particular book come together for you?
Yeah, actually, it came about because, you know, I had decided that I wanted to be a storyteller using both words and images. And my first book out was with the University Press of Florida on how to garden for wildlife in South Florida, because I live in South Florida and there's very few resources available for that. And so I was actually at a Florida Native Plant Society conference, and I ran into the editor from University of Florida Press who had produced that book. And she said, you know, we really like your photography. We'd love for you to do another book with us. Why don't you pitch an idea? And so I went home and I started looking at what was already out there. And it didn't take long to realize that there wasn't a very good comprehensive book on Florida's wildlife that covered the entire state, made the natural history accessible, and also was illustrated with good images. And so I decided that that was going to be my contribution to Florida's literature.
Well, we appreciate it. And this is not, I mean, new to you in terms of the photography, the travel. You've been to, I think, 7 continents, all of them 58 countries, and most of the U.S. states, capturing incredible photography from all over the world. What are some of the most interesting places that you've been, and what does photographing your home, how does that compare?
I mean, I have to say I'm a bit partial to Australia, partly because when I finished my biology degree and was kind of trying to figure out what was next, that was where I had been given my first camera just before I left for that trip. And so it was really the place where I started trying to figure out, like, well, what is this new medium and what can I do with it, and really exploring photography. And so Australia became kind of important to me because, well, first of all, also the biology is so different over there. They have so many different animals and landscapes than anything we have here in the U.S. So, and I was able to spend over a year there. So it was really inspiring and exciting time for me. But I think what's interesting is to bring those things back home where I know the biology so well, and to be able to kind of bring it all together, right? I wouldn't be able to get the images I got for this book if I didn't know the biology and the natural history as well as I do. So to be able to bring that background, you know, everything in Australia was like, oh, this is new and exciting. And, you know, a lot of it was like, well, I've never heard of an echidna before. What is this thing? Like, whereas here it's like, okay, I am being very intentional about this. I know all about the Florida panther, but how am I going to get one, right? And to be able to really kind of bring it home, and really all the things that I love, right? The biology, the being out in nature, and then having spent time kind of honing the storytelling and being able to bring it all together in a place that I'm more familiar with. Although I will say also, you know, one of the things that was surprising to me about this book was that I thought I knew Central and North Florida, and it turns out I didn't as well as I needed to write this kind of book. And so it too was, you know, an eye-opening exploration in its own way. And in a lot of ways made me fall in love with Florida again all over.
I am curious how long it took to do this. I mean, the book is so comprehensive in terms of the images. And, you know, there's a lot of people who go out and photograph one, you know, creature, and they're kind of in that habitat focusing and waiting. But you really had to go all over the state and wait for these incredible photos. So how much investment of time did it take?
A lot. It sort of worked out in my favor that it hit during COVID. I was working on the book during the pandemic. And so I spent most of the pandemic camping and hiking all over Florida by myself to do this book. And so it was really pretty intensive 2-year period of doing that. And then I also had some opportunities to, while the book was being reviewed, to get some more photos and so forth. So very intentionally, probably for like 2.5 years of, you know, wandering and then also writing it up. And I will also say that I started writing as soon as I had gotten the contract. And at this point, we're 5 years away from when I got that contract. But I started writing immediately. But then after spending all this time out there, I deleted all that text because it just didn't feel as intimate as I wanted it to. I wanted people to feel like they were in the woods with me, hiking, camping, you know, waiting for the critters. And so I ended up, after I had all the images already, I think part of what I like about this project was the fact that I was able to then, you know, create the words after I already had all the images. And so it was a bit of a crunch at the end. I had to ask for one more deadline extension so I could, you know, rewrite it all. But I think in the end, I was able to really pair them well and to give the reader a more intimate experience and a more firsthand account of, you know, what's so great about Florida.
I'm interested to know about that. I mean, your writing is nonfiction, but it's very descriptive and poetic. How did you find your voice in terms of, you know, this writing style? Obviously, you kind of went back from what you originally intended and redid a lot of it.
I did, yeah. I mean, I don't want this to sound trite, but I spent a lot of time working as a naturalist, a nature guide at a nature center here in Miami with fourth graders. And I just kept thinking about, well, how would I have made this exciting to fourth graders? How would I have made them feel like this is an exciting story? Come get into it with me. And so as I was writing, I literally would think about that occasionally, like, okay, how would I make this accessible to this fourth grader who I want to, you know, be excited about it? What would I tell them to get them excited? And so I really tried to infuse that in the writing. And I don't mean it to say like, oh, I wrote this for elementary school kids. I mean, hopefully they'll be able to understand it as well. But the point really was like, how do I make it engaging?
Right. We have a very specific question from a caller. Charles on the West Side wants to know what kind of lenses you use.
For most of the pictures in this book were taken with a 100 to 500 millimeter lens, a Canon.
Okay. And then I just, oh, go ahead.
I was going to say that I have since switched to, I'm working on a bird identification guide at the moment, and I'm now using an 800 millimeter for that. But that's because, you know, for birds, you have to get really close to be able to see all of the identifying features. So it was a different ball game. But for this one, it was almost all 100 to 500.
Just briefly, you've been nominated for a couple of book awards recently. Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
I have, and actually it's been really gratifying because I think the things that hopefully comes out as we're talking is that I was really excited about both the writing and the photography, and they both just won independent awards. So I got the Nonfiction Book Award for the National League of American Pen Women, and they didn't even see the pictures. They just saw pieces of the text.
Oh, hey.
And then I also got the gold medal in visual arts for the Florida Book Award. So
not just nominations, victories. That's terrific. That's congratulations on that.
Thank you. I'm very excited about that, actually.
Well, Kirsten, thank you so much for your time. You can find out more about Kirsten and her books at kirstenhines.com. And we'll be back in just a minute with a local celebration of Black arts and culture.
All the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged all the people an arm and a leg just to see. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? To pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
Life South Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with Life South helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
The Jacksonville Music Experience presents innovative Grammy-nominated jazz harpist Brandi Younger live on the WJCT Soundstage on Thursday, March 14th. Doors at 7 p.m., show starts at 8. Tickets and more information at jacksmusic.org/events.
On the next Fresh Air, Eugene Levy gets out of his comfort zone for his series, The Reluctant Traveler. Levy starred in the comedy series Schitt's Creek, that's S-C-H-I-T-T apostrophe S Creek, the fictional town the series is set in, co-starred in the sketch comedy series SCTV, and co-starred in several mockumentaries, including Best in Show. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Age. It's become an election issue for both Donald Trump and President Joe Biden. The president is starting to push back.
The issue facing our nation isn't how old we are, it's how old are our ideas.
Why we care about age in our politicians. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Hi, I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. I report on the shakeups, challenges, and trends in the news industry, including here at NPR, because sometimes the media is the story. I also cover the relationships between the press and politicians and how news outlets are fighting disinformation. All of this is even more relevant in an election year. Please help NPR keep trustworthy information coming your way by making a donation to this station today. And thanks.
Please call 904-353-9528 and thanks.
And we're back. In collaboration with the Ritz Theater and Museum, MOSH will host its second annual Power event this Saturday. The event showcases Black art, history, and culture in Northeast Florida. And to talk about all that it entails, I'm joined by Dr. Anthony Mortimer, MOSH's VP of Education and Exhibits. Hey, Anthony.
Good morning.
Good to have you back. So tell us about the purpose of MOSH's Passport series writ large.
Absolutely. This is a series of events that we are quite proud of and that's having a great impact throughout the Northeast Florida community. The purpose of the Passport series is to take all the history parts of Museum of Science and History and put a modern cultural lens on it of why does all this old dusty stuff matter now? And it's a change in approach from how it used to be presented and really redefining the relationship of the museum with the community. So what we do in Passport Series events is partner with local nonprofit organizations and individuals that are viewed as leaders within their cultural communities. Jacksonville is a marvelously diverse city, but these events are not about MOSH. They're about bringing the city closer together.
And so this one is focused on Black arts and culture, but you last year did a Hispanic Heritage Month event.
Correct.
Highlighting that community in Jacksonville. And later this month, you have an iftar event, which is the traditional Ramadan dinner. So a broad range, but all very rich communities in Jacksonville.
Absolutely. And there's many things that the community learns together with us through these. Many people, even those who grew up here, don't realize that Jacksonville has these large communities. There's a lot of knowledge of the history of the Black community in Jacksonville, going all the way back to historical La Villa. And that is one of the reasons why we've partnered with the Ritz this year on this event is if you have not been there, please go check out their collection. The Ritz is an amazing place full of very rich history.
So this Power event, tell us about some of the components of it and who is featured.
There's a little bit of everything in here. So if I leave someone out who's listening, don't worry, you're still on the event. So you get a really good combination throughout the night, and we've scheduled them so that you can really get a little piece of everything. So something different that we're doing this year, we are starting off the evening at 5 o'clock with a film screening.
And tell us, what day is this?
This is this Saturday, the 16th,
okay.
From 5 to 10 p.m.
Okay, so you're starting off at 5 with,
Film screening. There are a couple of options here. Right now we're planning on the film The Banker. And this is courtesy of Black Films Matter, which is a local nonprofit run by Mr. Trey Ford. And he will be one of our panelists for the panel discussions later as well. The other panelists we have, along with Mr. Ford, are Dr. Diana Green of the Children's Literacy Initiative.
Former superintendent.
Correct. And Ms. Erica Willey, who runs the nonprofit Sciences.
She was on our show recently. Yeah.
She's a new partner, and we did an event with her a couple weeks ago that was just amazing. We had over 300 people celebrating local Black women in STEM careers. In addition to the panel discussions and the film screening, we have live art demonstrations. Teresa Cook is going to be doing some watercolor demonstrations.
Tell
and you've seen
her
work.
Yeah, she's extraordinary. Tell us, though, for people who haven't seen.
Absolutely amazing. She does these mostly landscapes and architecture. Just amazing artwork, but she's also a very good teacher. For someone like me who... I do not consider myself artistic in any way. I wished I could, but I just can't draw. So she has a really great way of bringing people in to participate and learning through the process. And at the end, they've created something that they didn't know they could do. And that's really the focus, is not just focusing on the talent that is here locally, but also the meaning behind creating things. So in addition to Teresa, we've got Mr. Mike Hernandez, who's going to do a little 3D printing tutorial. So Mike makes life-size Comic-Con style 3D printed things, and he's going to talk about how you can do 3D printing at home and give recommendations on affordable and high-quality 3D printers. And he's created a signature piece just for the event that'll be raffled off as well throughout the night.
Is this an event where people kind of bop in and out, or is it an event that people come and attend the entire beginning to end?
At either one, whatever fits your schedule and what you want to do that evening. This is a family-friendly event, so if you want to stay for a couple hours from the beginning, or if you want to be there the whole night, we've got from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock, we've got the local band Straight Up will be performing in the Brian Gooding Planetarium. So that'll be a unique venue.
Oh, yeah. Is the show going to be the planetarium activated?
We're going to have some overhead, yes.
Excellent.
It'll be interesting and fun, and it's a very talented band.
So instead of a disco ball, you'll kind of have the lights of
exactly.
The stars.
So the ticket includes food as well. We've got some appetizer selections from One Foxy Lady Cafe and some dessert options from the Mixed Fillings Pie Shop.
Well, Dr. Anthony Mortimer from Mosh, thank you so much for being here, and good luck with the event this weekend on Saturday.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Hope to see everybody here.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock. You can also find our entire archive at wjct.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Be sure to stick around and join us tomorrow. We're going to be talking about the possibility of reconciliation and peace in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.